Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, July 23rd, 2023. My name is Bill McCann. I'll read a featured story, My Impossible Mission to Find Tom Cruise. The action star has gone to great lengths to avoid the press for more than a decade. But maybe our writer could track him down anyway. There's a picture right next to the title. It's a drawing, kind of cartoonish. And you could see Tom Cruise's blue eyes peeking through the bushes. It's obviously him, and he's surrounded by all these exotic plants, yellow, purple, blue, green. It's a story by Katie Weaver. In an interview with Playboy in 2012, Tom Cruise described Katie Holmes as an extraordinary person with a wonderful clothing line and someone for whom he was fond of doing things like creating romantic dinners, behavior that he confided she enjoys. It would prove to be his last major interview with a reporter to date. Despite what may be called through the penumbra of memory, this sudden silence was not directly preceded by either of Cruise's infamous appearances on television, not by his NBC's Today Show interview, in which he labeled host Matt Lauer both glib and Matt, nor even by his appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show, in which he reverse catapulted himself onto Winfrey's fawn-colored couch multiple times in a demonstration of his enthusiasm for Holmes. Those incidents occurred 7 years earlier. 2005, Cruise emerged from the hex of public bewilderment unscathed. In fact, Cruise gave no indication that the interview, pegged to the musical comedy bomb Rock of Ages, was intended to serve as a farewell address to journalists. At the time he sat for it, another life milestone was hurtling toward him. The month after the article was published, Holmes filed for divorce. In the decades since, the amount of verified information we have gleaned about Cruise's real life could fit on a single flashcard, though it's unclear why anyone would need to memorize it, since the details mainly consist of anecdotal trifles shared by other celebrities in interviews of their own. From James Corden, we know Cruise once asked to land a helicopter in James Corden's yard. From Brooke Shields, we know Brooke Shields no longer receives the, by all accounts, delectable white chocolate coconut bundt cake that Cruise famously sends to many beloved stars each holiday season. From Kira Sedgwick, we know that there was a panic button under a fireplace mantel in one of Cruise's homes. She pressed it out of curiosity, summoning the police. From Matt Damon, we know that during production of the fourth Mission Impossible movie, Cruise had a safety guy replaced because he deemed a proposed stunt in which Cruise scampers over the Burj Khalifa too dangerous. Tom Cruise, Kate Hudson informs us, loves skydiving. These facts sketch a portrait of a daredevil with a finite budget for cakes, but hardly a recluse. Cruise's spurning of interviews makes him unique among his cohort, A-list, pathologically charismatic, rest butts into seats type movie stars, whose success, it has long been assumed, derives from their ability to appear likable to mortals. They demonstrate this skill traditionally by exhibiting their personalities in interviews. Every time Cruise turns down an interview request through his representative, Cruise declined to be interviewed for this article, he makes a bet that just his being Tom Cruise, offering no further details about what that might entail, is enticement enough for people to watch his movies. Lately, more often than not, he's been right. To see this clearly, perhaps it's helpful to contrast Cruise's career with that of Brad Pitt, his co-star in Interview with the Vampire. 1994, and fellow member of a declining species, Hollywood-leaning men. Pitt has continued appearing in the kinds of films, thrillers, comedies, romances, psychodramas, historical epics, etc., that he and crew starred in throughout the 90s and 2000s. In the past decade, audiences could find Pitt endeavoring to disappear into roles ranging from abolitionist to astronaut. In the same period, Cruz has starred solely in action films, which have depicted him fighting aliens, terrorists, fellow spies, a mummy, and sundry other enemies of the United States. Rather than vanishing into roles, Cruz remakes them in his image. So fully has he melded his off-screen persona with that of the skydiving, cliff-jumping, motorcycle, parachuting pilots he portrays, these characters become mere receptacles of Thomas Cruise-ness. Cruise's films tend to perform better than Pitt's at the box office. His most recent endeavor, Top Gun Maverick, out-earned Pitt's latest by about $1.4 billion. This summer, Tom Cruise will run, drive, and jump at top speeds in Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1. And Brad Pitt will star in nothing. Cruise still takes part in promotional junkets and convivial late-night talk show chats, but his refusal to participate in the sort of in-depth journalistic interviews that, in theory anyway, reveal some aspect of his true self has coincided, somewhat paradoxically, with an incredible surge in his commitment to infusing cinematic fantasies with reality. For unknown reasons, it could be interesting to explore in an interview. Reality has become very important to Cruz, who reveres it as a force more powerful than magic. It's vital to Cruz that the audience of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 have the opportunity to witness not a CGI production of a feat, or even a seasoned stunt performer executing a dangerous act, but real footage of him. Tom Cruise, the 61-year-old father of three from Syracuse, New York, riding a motorcycle off a cliff. This fetish for reality has become a keystone of Cruise's persona, to the extent that many of his public appearances now take place in flying vehicles. Rather than accept an MTV Movie and TV Award in person in May, Cruise filmed his acceptance speech from the cockpit of a fighter jet as he piloted it through the clouds, politely shouting, "I love entertaining you," over the engine's roar. Delivering a special message from the set of Mission Impossible to his followers on Instagram, Cruise screamed while dangling backward off the side of an aircraft. "It truly is the honor of a lifetime." But reality doesn't exist only in movies. What is missing from Cruise's fervid documentation of ultra-risky, inconceivably expensive, meticulously planned real-life events are any details about the parts of his real life that do not involve, for example, filming stunts for Mission Impossible movies. My own mission then was simple. I was to travel to the ends of the earth to see if it was possible to locate the terrestrial Cruise out of context, to catch a glimpse, to politely shout one question at him, or at least to ascertain one new piece of intelligence about his current existence in order to reintegrate him into our shared reality. Having lately made an effort to scrutinize any article that cast Tom Cruise as its subject, one of the few things I can say for certain he has done since 2021, besides film two Mission Impossible movies, is order chicken tikka masala from a restaurant in Birmingham, England, and then, as soon as he had finished, per a tweet from the restaurant, order the exact same chicken tikka masala all over again. These days, Cruise is hardly ever photographed in any situation other than shooting and promoting his films. He was filming in Birmingham. The paucity of paparazzi photos of the apparently chicken-loving actor can be at least partly attributed to his spending much time removed from America's twin celebrity entertainment control rooms, New York, where his ex-wife Holmes lives with their daughter, and Los Angeles, where in 2015 and 16, he reportedly sold multiple homes for a combined total just over $50 million. Years of speculation that Cruz lives or was planning to live in a penthouse apartment, a five-minute walk from the spiritual headquarters of the Church of Scientology, of which he is a big fan, in Clearwater, Florida, appear never to have been realized, apart from an unsourced assertion published in The Hollywood Reporter in 2018, which mentioned that the audition process for co-stars in Cruise's Top Gun Maverick involved flying down to Cruise's home in Clearwater. To learn more about the possible activities of Tom Cruise, I turned to the person who, after Cruise himself, his family, his friends, his employees, his co-workers, and anyone who has ever met or at least interacted with him, knows him best. A Brazilian woman who is quite possibly his most dedicated fan in the world. She spoke to me on two conditions. First, that I grant her anonymity. Second, that I not identify by name or characterize too specifically the publicly available online repository of Cruz's related information she has maintained for over 20 years. Her concerns are both practical and legal. Practically, she isn't sure if the operation, which may or may not play host to more than 132,000 images of Cruz, could withstand a large influx of traffic. Legally, she didn't wish to invite the scrutiny and possible copyright claims the attention might draw. She started the operation when she was 18. Today, she is in her early 40s and works as a librarian. More than two decades into the endeavor, a nostalgic melancholy permeates the fan's reflections. 10 years ago, she said she was often the first to widely disseminate the latest images of Cruz. Now, because of the superabundance of photo-sharing social media accounts, she must settle for merely having the most complete repository. New additions trickle in sporadically. She's partial to the theory that paparazzi rarely capture photographs of Cruz, in part because he is a real-life master of disguise who people fail to recognize on the street. Despite years of remote observation, of scrutinizing nearly every single image captured of the man, even she couldn't say definitively where Cruz lives. She did observe, however, that he appears to spend most of his time in Britain. In fact, there is a strange rumor that Cruz bought a home in a tiny town called Biggin Hill on the farthest fringes of London, the site of a small private airport that he's been known to use when filming in the region. The legend appears to trace back to an article published in the British tabloid The Sun in July 2021 about the actor's 59th birthday celebration. An anonymous source declared that Cruz had, quote, only recently moved to a house in Biggin Hill, average home price £590,000, which feels like it's practically in the countryside. The claim would accrue scant new details as it was repeated in British papers numerous times over the following year, apart from one, that Cruz's residence is set in 140 acres of stunning rural parkland inside a posh, gated community near the airport. Cruz, who's filmed parts of the three most recent installments of Mission Impossible in Britain, has never publicly commented on the rumors. He did, however, confirm that he spends a lot of time in Britain in an exceedingly rare interview that appeared inexplicably in the September 2022 issue of Derbyshire Life magazine. "I guess I'm an Anglophile," Cruz told Derbyshire Life. "I love being in Britain because everyone is pleasant and will give you a nod or say hello without crowding you too much." Elsewhere in the interview, Cruz expressed additional enthusiasm for auxiliary British topics, including politeness. "Being friendly doesn't cost a bean, and I enjoy it. And Derbyshire, which is, for the record, actually a considerable distance from Biggin Hill. Wow, Derbyshire, what a fantastic place. To determine if anyone who didn't work in the British newspaper or chicken tikka masala industries had ever encountered crews on English soil, I sifted through Facebook posts, typing any permutation of Saw Tom Cruise I could think of into the search bars of neighborhood groups for all of the hobbitly named localities surrounding Biggin Hill, Orpington, West Wickham. I joined groups like Westerham and Biggin Hill News Friends, Community Fund Views, Gossip, and pored over hundreds of responses to posts like, "Think I just saw Tom Cruise driving down Jail Lane. That's impossible." The flashes of Cruise that winked from the replies were tantalizing. "I've seen him, blue Ferrari, Jail Lane. Lives up Cudham, drives blue Ferrari." But there was no way to tell who was reporting accurate details about the comings and goings of Tom Cruise, who was mistaken, who was merely lying for fun. The only way to find out what to do, what Cruise himself would do, grab onto the nearest plane and go, for real. Next to the Biggin Hill Airport, there's a pocket-sized hotel built to serve the crews and engineers of the private planes that fly in and out. The hotel, its website boasts, offers great views toward London, something just about any place on earth could offer with the right window arrangement, assuming it was not already in London. The description of the property's sleek, teal, and toffee-colored restaurant turned out to be even more specifically accurate. The view of the runway at Biggin Hill Airport was without parallel. At the bar, I pulled up a leather stool and ordered, not in these exact words, the worst Shirley Temple of my life, which cost $11. My fellow patrons had long since familiarized themselves with the contours of the small dinner menu. They had been stranded by Biggin Hill for some time because the private jet of the billionaires for whom they were working had received, you hate to hear this, an estimated $10 million worth of hail damage. I asked a maintenance technician if he thought Tom Cruise really did have a house in Biggin Hills. He replied with unflinching confidence, "I know he does." The same venue, a man so young he might have been a teenager, who at one time worked inside the airport, revealed to me that Cruise had a parking spot there, though it was unclear if he meant for a car or a helicopter. Most of the good people of Biggin Hill, when grilled about Cruise's living arrangements, seemed genuinely to have no idea what I was talking about. These were the two camps into which, without fail, every respondent fell. Either they had never so much as heard the rumor that Tom Cruise walked among them, or they were 100% sure, certain that he did. Upon reaching Keston Park, the only gated community in the area matching the son's description, I discovered two things. First, that there appeared to be an illegally locked gate obstructing public access to the footpath that cuts through the neighborhood. Whether the gate is impenetrable is a matter of ongoing dispute among the Bromley Borough Council, myself and many other aspiring path takers who have submitted complaints about the locked gate to the borough website. And second, that the biggest movie star in the world did not live there. That was evident through holes that carpenter bees had bored into the barbed wire topped fences protecting Keston Park from the wider world. The stately houses faced one another too directly. Their trees could drop acorns into another's gardens. There was nowhere to conveniently land a helicopter. Oh well, these were Keston Park's problems, not mine, and probably not Tom Cruise's. Tom Cruise, as he and I both now knew, was most likely secretly living at another estate I had turned up in my research, one that was even closer to the airport. The distance between any two points within the general environs of Biggin Hill is insignificant by car, which is probably why I was unable to persuade any taxi driver to transport me between them. It's less insignificant by foot and even longer, though much more scenic if one attempts to traverse it by way of the aforementioned footpaths. These meandering trails tended to be spectacularly beautiful, bursting with a vernal lushness that was nearly pornographic. House-high frozen fountains of easy white hawthorn blossoms shaded dusty walkways. Wild roses as pink as country time lemonade exploded from leafy hedges. Fragile sapphire speedwells, fat purple clover tops, and buttercups strewn like gold confetti. These were merely the things it was impossible not to step on. The fluorescent green of the meadows recalled the grasses of another royal province, Super Mario's Mushroom Kingdom. Poppies and toad flax sprang out obscenely from stone walls. Tom Cruise would be crazy not to live here, I thought as I stroked the soft, sun-warmed mane of a little white donkey. Let's all live here. Except, on my arrival at the end of an idyllic woodland stroll, I discovered that Cruise didn't live there either. There was, in the front yard of this residence, a garden gnome lugging buckets on a yoke, which didn't seem like Cruise's style, and the gnome was overturned, lying on its side. Definitely not his style. I righted the gnome and ambled on in search of another public footpath that would, I hoped, lead me to where Cruise actually lived. Instead, I accidentally wandered into what, I learned through being yelled this information, was not a public right-of-way, but a field privately owned by a woman who berated me until I ran into traffic on a nearby road. That night, with half my allotted exploratory mission time used up, I lay awake in the hotel built for the flight attendants of billionaires, jets, miserable and panicked at my failure to do anything but incur thousands of dollars in expenses for airfare and one Shirley Temple. Surely this wasn't all for naught. Surely some meaning could possibly be derived from an interaction between a movie star and a magazine journalist, even a brief one, even one in which the movie star had already said, through his publicist, he didn't want to participate, even one in which the star was not present, since some understanding of some dimension of his life could doubtless be gleaned through a study of his surroundings. But what if Cruise has been so successful in removing himself from our world that I would never find any trace of him? What if Cruise had evanesced into a high-octane mist of pure entertainment? Did I have time to just go to every single house in England and check if Cruise was home? How big was this nation? Why was the sun rising now in the middle of the night? What time was it? Had I accidentally not gone to sleep all night? I had one more idea. On my first day in town, I had stopped at a pub for lunch. I was told that there was a funeral going on and that there was an hour wait for food, but that if I ordered something simple like a sandwich, the wait would be less. So I ordered a sandwich, which actually took 90 minutes to arrive and was so, no offense, disgusting tasting that I turned around and asked a middle-aged man sitting at the picnic table behind mine if he would like a half a sandwich. No. And if it always took so long to receive a sandwich at this pub. Unclear. And if it was true that Tom Cruise really lived nearby. He's here, the man said to me. Do you know, or are you guessing? He's definitely around here, that's for sure, he said. I know where he is. At first, with the cagey pride of one who knows the favorite hovering spot of an actual ghost, who acts as self-appointed doorman of the thin place between worlds, the man made a show of not telling me where. But then, on his way out, he materialized at my elbow and proffered three clues, his word. It's within 2 miles of the airport, he said. Look for the biggest house. And I mean, his voice dropped to a whisper, the biggest. It's a very famous house, he said. The anti-establishment of slavery started there. I was aware of this property from my earlier research. It was a colossal, butter-colored manor once owned by a prime minister, William Pitt the Younger. I eliminated it from contention as a possible cruise residence because it was sold in 2018, 8.5 million pounds, to a used car magnate who, at least judging by an article from 2020 that I read in Car Dealer magazine, appeared to be quite comfortably ensconced in it. But it was only a few miles away. On foot, the journey could be completed in just over an hour. How exactly I ended up on the edge of that woman's privately owned field again, I have no idea. The expedition to that point, it seemed to take me through brand new areas. All of a sudden, I noticed that the path had dissipated into dense forest. This is just like what happened yesterday when I trespassed in that woman's field, I thought, then looked up and spotted her house in the distance. I panicked. I frightened a badger. Likewise, babe, and bolted through the forest as quickly as I could in a new, randomly chosen direction. This deposited me into a vast, previously unencountered field. On all previous paths, vigorously growing cow parsley had stood on slender stems about shin high. Here, upright hordes of it grazed my shoulders, while fallen comrades entangled my ankles. Needles of true panic prickled my nape under sweaty hair. Statistically speaking, I assured myself, it was unlikely I would be trapped in this field so long that I would die here. Although, wouldn't it serve that woman right if I did die in this field so close to her own, where I was not allowed? That'd teach her a lesson, I said in the audio recorder I had brought in case I encountered Tom Cruise. Have to find some way to notify her, I explained, of my death. Hopefully she would see my picture in a newspaper. That would be another good thing about dying out here, I told the recorder. It would serve the editor who recklessly assigned me this article, who had irresponsibly approved my travel budget, right. It'd probably ruin his life, or at least his work life. God, would he be fired? Would he be fired? Certainly, at the very least, he would get in trouble. You should never have sent her to a small English town. Would our boss tell him not to blame himself? Hopefully not. I'm dead because of him. I didn't want to die, of course, but if it did happen, at least I would die doing what I loved, making people feel bad and be in trouble deservedly. I had yet to clearly develop a mental image of my widowed husband's second wife when I realized that I had stumbled midfield upon a dirt path leading into a neighborhood. I ran down it in. I was shocked to discover the exact direction of the used car dealer's palatial estate. The public footpath alongside the property, which, if a man drinking outside a pub at 2 p.m. is to be believed, is inhabited by Tom Cruise, looked like the aisle down which a fairy princess would glide at her wedding. Actually, no, even nicer. It was like the flower-strewn tunnel of light she would pass through following her death from being viciously yelled at for walking in a private field by accident on her journey to eternity. It wound beneath protective arches of graceful branches trailing heaps of white and pink blossoms. A gentle, constant wind rippled the flowers just enough to allow dappled sunlight to illuminate a trail through their lovely shade. So vast were the grounds, so lush the foliage, that the home itself was not visible from any vantage point. I listened for the distant, throaty cry of a blue Ferrari, but heard only a songbird. The recorded owner of the estate made no response to my later attempts to contact him to ask if, perchance, Tom Cruise, possibly in elaborate disguise, could be living in his house. Even if Cruise has no connection to the residence, this absolute lack of response serves to further obscure his existence. Not only is it impossible to determine where he lives, it isn't even possible to determine where he does not live. The distance between Cruise and the average human remains unshrinkable. At a time when social media renders movie stars ever present in the public field of vision, accessible to some extent through whatever scrupulously vetted personal information they share, but also broadly trackable via webs of celebrity watching accounts that widely disseminate photos and rumors. Cruz has distinguished himself by becoming a comet. When between protracted silences, absences, his inscrutable orbit brings him back into Earth's visible realm, he briefly commands the simultaneous attention of all its peoples. Thank you to the people of Abu Dhabi, read a June post on his Instagram account, alongside a photo of him greeting a crowd at a Dead Reckoning Part 1 premiere. Also appreciated and acknowledged by their servant Sovereign for their attendance at other Dead Reckoning Part 1 premieres, the people of Rome, everyone in Seoul. At the conclusion of this promotional cycle, after Cruz has thanked everyone for allowing him to create world-class summer cinema, he will almost certainly disappear, not to be heard from again until next year, at which point his reemergence will proclaim the arrival of Dead Reckoning Part 2. This vanishing, while perhaps rooted in avoidance of a press corps that asks questions he doesn't want to answer, is massaged into something like a sacrificial duty to audiences. In disappearing the moment his work is through, always, like Santa Claus, with the promise of return, Cruz retains the mystique that so many Hollywood stars have lost this century. He goes away so that audiences may experience the thrill of his reappearance and delight in the promise of movie magic he heralds. Of course, it's possible that Tom Cruise doesn't even know that the gargantuan house in the quiet English village exists. But if we assume, perhaps foolishly, that he does live there, I did ascertain one new detail about his reality. He was in the process of having a long private driveway that weaves through the woods and stretches to the unseen manor beyond redone. It looks awesome. Katie Weaver is a staff writer for the magazine. She last wrote about going on a package trip for youngish people. I'll read the talk section. Joyce Carol Oates figured out the secret to immortality. The interview is David Marchese. I have, Joyce Carol Oates says, so many ideas. That's putting it mildly. It's hard to think of another writer with as fecund and protean an imagination as the 85-year-old, who is surely on any short list of America's greatest living writers. Oates, whose latest is the unsettling short story collection Zero Sum, has published 62 novels, 47 short story collections, 16 collections of nonfiction, 9 collections of poetry, plays and books for children and young adults, as well as a torrent of tweets, the latter of which occasionally gets her in trouble. The sheer quantity of her output, impressive as it may be, is almost beside the point. The real achievement is that the quality of that work is so consistently high. You can be confident that if you throw a dart at the Oates catalog, you'll hit a piece of writing that is emotionally intense, full of knife-sharp sentences and painterly descriptions, rich with thematic daring and grave moral and philosophical reckoning, and now and then, a morbid sense of humor. You can also be confident that there's more on the way. I have a stack of notes for my next novel and another novel, and I have a lot of short stories, Oates says excitedly. The one I'm doing now, the reader's going to be surprised. David asks, in your book on boxing, you have a line about how for fighters, life is about the fight and the rest is just waiting. Do you feel that way with writing? That's a good question. Points to a philosophical issue of what is essential in our lives and what is existential or incidental. Thinking of my early married life, my husband was a professor and we talked about books all the time. though we talked and talked for years, I don't really remember that dialogue. I don't remember the students I was teaching, whom I loved. In 2023, and I have to concede that I don't remember those students. All I have left of all that happiness is my writing of that time, a book or two, some stories. I think that's a profound fact. It's a kind of devastating fact. Everything that you think is solid is actually fleeting and ephemeral. The only thing that is quasi-permanent would be a book or work of art or photographs or something. Anything you create that transcends time is in some way more real than the actual reality of your life. If you set your hand on fire right now, it's ephemeral. It would hurt, but Plato would say it's not as real as something that transcends time. I'm a person who was married and was very happily married, yet that's all gone now. Where is it? Does it give you any solace to know that you at least have those books that you wrote during that period of happiness? Does it give you any solace to know that you at least have those books that you wrote during that period of happiness? I suppose it has some solace to it. Otherwise, things would all be lost. Did you see the movie The Great Beauty? It's about a man who's 65 years old. He wrote a good novel that people liked, but then he was taken up by the beauty of Rome. In a way, he says he wasted his life. People are seduced by the beauty of the close at hand, and they don't have the discipline or the predilection or the talent, maybe, to say, I'm not going to go out tonight. I'm not going to waste my time on Twitter. I'm going to have 5 hours and work on my novel. If you did that every day, you'd have a novel. Most people say, I'm going to pet my cat, or I'm with my children. There's lots of reasons that people have for not doing things. Then the cats are gone, children move away, the marriage breaks up, or somebody dies, and you're sort of there like, I don't have anything. A lot of things that have meaning are gone, and you have to start anew. But if you read Ovid's Metamorphoses, Ovid writes about how, if you're reading this, I'm immortal. You see that theme in Shakespeare's sonnets. You're reading this, so I'm still alive. In fact, they're not alive, they're gone. But while they were alive, they did have that extra dimension of their lives. That is not nothing. David says, so having a body of work to leave behind ameliorates the feeling of things being gone from your life? I don't know how to answer that. I was very close to my parents, and like many people who love their parents, I didn't think I would survive without them, but you do. We start losing people. We lose our grandparents, parents. We start losing friends. You lose a spouse. That's the human experience, and you suddenly realize that the human experience is going to be your experience. When that starts to happen to you, it's quite stunning. But I think as people get older, we get more tolerant. I remember after my first husband died, I couldn't sleep, and I would look at movies late at night, and leaving Las Vegas was on a lot. While my husband was alive, I would never have seen a movie about an alcoholic. I didn't have any patience with anything like that. But after he died, I thought, of course everybody's self-medicating. I had a totally different interpretation of the movie. I understand now what self-medication means. It's not necessarily weakness. It's how people are able to keep going. And David, just on that notion of tolerance, how do you see the shift that has occurred in what's tolerated from writers? A writer like you or a friend of yours like Philip Roth could be pretty provocative in a way that feels rare nowadays. And Joyce says, everything is evolutionary and we have a different consciousness now. Our society is much more obviously diverse than it was when Philip started writing. He was a young Jewish man, but he wasn't mainstream Jewish in the sense of being religious. He was secular. So he was writing out of that perspective, and he was attacked by older Jewish critics because he seemed like he was sneering at American Jews at a time after World War II when that seemed unkind. But he gets a different sensibility as he gets older. Sort of widens. Philip always remained, to some extent, a brash, adolescent voice, and he was best when he was being funny and mocking. But he didn't seem to have the humanity or capacity of, say, Bernard Malamud. I'm not sure why I got on that subject, but Philip also took a stance against feminism because he felt that was challenging the authority of the white male. His writing was extremely sexist. If you read it from his position, you could still sort of enjoy it. And John Updike's occasional sexism didn't bother me at all because they're very good writers. People who are younger now, of a different generation than Philip and me and John Updike, see the world differently. They see things in a much more egalitarian way. Like, why not have a lesbian writing from her point of view? Why must it always be the white male? Why would the white writer be wanting to write about a black subject? It's not that you can't do it, but why would you want to when that's their world and they know that world? A white writer, we have so many things we can do. Why, we don't have to go over to somebody else's garden and be picking around. David, how does support for the idea that diverse voices should be given primacy in telling their stories jibe with the tweet of yours, which made a lot of people angry, where you seem to lament hearing an anecdote about how book publishers aren't interested in first novels by white male writers? I guess I assume that it's like saying water is wet. Publishers don't publish enough diverse voices. I thought we knew that. I was responding to another tweet. A bunch of the time I get in trouble on Twitter, I'm retweeting somebody else and commenting, and then my tweet gets taken out of context. But I was saying, yes, an agent told me this. People told me, Joyce, it's true, but we don't say it. You shouldn't say it. I was offering reasons why I thought it might be true, and one of them is that publishers publish to make money, and it might be that for publishers, when they publish a book by a white male who's not famous, like Stephen King, it doesn't sell as much, but Twitter is so truncated, can't get much of an argument out, and everything seems to be like racism. You just wave a flag. People seem reluctant to understand that there are other factors in the world. I think class is much more important. Black people and persons of color who are wealthy, they have much more in common with white people who are wealthy. People don't seem to want to talk about class in America. I'm from a working class background, so I see things in terms of class struggle. After that, there's a picture. Shows Oates receiving a National Humanities Medal from President Barack Obama in 2011. David says, I read an old piece you wrote for the New York Times Book Review about the appeal of anonymity for writers and how their work can be affected or hemmed in by the public's perception of who they are outside the work. Did something flip where now you don't care about that? Doesn't matter to you if people might think about you differently because every once in a while you put a howler out there on Twitter. She says, I don't think about it too much. It may be because I'm living alone and people in my generation, we used to have 5 conversations a day. That's all gone. For some people, Twitter takes up that time of the day when you're in your Zen consciousness where everything is finite. It's not permanent. It's like a flame that flickers and goes out. Also, in quoting something that I said years ago, you're making a common mistake that people are fixed. That is a philosophical question, too. What is essential in your being and what is contingent and accidental? Somebody says to you, you should be on Twitter because if you post where you're going to give your readings, people can see where you're going. They set it up for you and you start tweeting. You just sort of go down a dark path. Much of life is accidental. David says, when new feelings or ideas bubble up in the culture, do you immediately think, here's something for me to write about? Or do you have to spend time figuring out if they're viable subject matter for you? I'm thinking of pandemic fears or anxiety about humans being replaced by AI, both of which you write about at Zero Sum. It's more taken from my own experience. We had a lockdown around March 15th, 2020. I'd been teaching at Princeton and Rutgers, and suddenly the whole state was locked down. I was living alone, and I would be awake much of the night. In the news, the death tolls kept rising. There began to be stories about bodies in morgues in New York City, or in vans outside the morgues. I was trying to get back to that sense of isolation and unease, but only because I experienced it. I probably wouldn't have been writing about it otherwise. And this is not a drill. The idea that perhaps this is going to be a recurring experience in the Western societies, that suddenly the technology will fail and we'll be hearing sirens, you'll be told to stay in your house, didn't seem too far-fetched. So you use your own feelings as a way into the story? Yes. Is it the same process for a story like the new book's Mr. Stickum, where you're inhabiting a dark, murderous perspective? Presumably, that's something with which you don't have experience. Well, it's a collective perspective of girls who are in high school, and they have a certain privilege, and so they think they're helping girls or women who are made to be sex slaves. But that was a fun story. I have a whole category of fun stories. They are usually very macabre and somewhat over the top. I'm working on a novel now, and it's really a fun novel. I look forward to writing it. I hope it doesn't get canceled. We're in an era that I would not have predicted, where a novel could be canceled because of its premise. My goodness, some of our great outrageous writers like Nabokov would never get published today. What's the premise of the novel? My novel? Oh, I don't think I will tell you. I call it fun novel because the plot's very complicated. I've written a lot of very serious novels like Breathe, in which there's no humor. But plotting a novel that's complicated is a lot of fun. David says, when you were talking before about how people spend time on things when they could be writing a novel, was there an implicit judgment in there? Do you think the people who don't leave something like that behind spend their time on the wrong things? David, there are some questions that arise when one is being interviewed that would never otherwise have arisen. I often have that feeling after an interview that it represents a little bubble in my life, almost like a bubble in one's blood moving toward the heart like a clot. I focus so much on my work, then when I'm asked to make some abstract comment, I kind of reach for a clue from the interviewer. I don't want to suggest that there's anything artificial about it, but I don't know what I'm supposed to say, in a way, because I wouldn't otherwise be saying it. Sartre said, I don't even particularly like Sartre, but he did say something very revealing. Genius is not a gift, but the way a person invents in desperate circumstances. Much of what I'm doing is I'm backed into a corner, and the way out is desperation. So no, I don't necessarily feel that was a judgment. How would I know what it would be like to have 15 wonderful grandchildren? I didn't raise horses. I didn't have dogs. There are many things I haven't done that make people happy and fulfilled. I'm not passing any judgment. I'm backed into a corner that is my identity. I don't have experiences of other things. I don't think about these things unless somebody asks me. I'm thinking about the next chapter in my novel. I worked all morning on one and a half pages. I feel so interested in the next chapter. It's like jumping into some water. You don't know if it's going to be cold or warm, but it's exciting. That's the way I live. I'm not thinking about these philosophical overall questions. David says, often people I interview will say, that's not something I think about, or I haven't really thought about that. Exactly. But how boring would it be if all I did was ask about things people had already thought about? But I understand what you're saying. There's an element of being put on the spot. Well, it's ironic because I just posted a Substack about the idea of an interview. It's actually quite a fascinating genre. It's very American. The interview. Different interviews come out of the interviewer. It's like you're striding out into the Barnum and Bailey circus. You have your whip. The lions come and jump through the flaming hoops, but they're doing it for you. if somebody else was there, maybe the lions would just come padding out quietly and lie down and have a nap. It's a wonderful experience, I suppose, to be an interviewer. You have the capacity to create the interview in your own image. Anyway, this is not to say that there was anything wrong about my statement to you. It's that there's almost nothing I can say that isn't simply an expression of a person trying desperately to say something. She laughs. After Cormac McCarthy died, the Times ran an essay saying that his career couldn't happen today. Did you see that? Yes, I think I responded to it on Twitter. It's probably true. Could your career happen today? Gosh, I don't know. I really am an experimental writer, and I sort of downplayed that because experimental writing doesn't sell. But when I looked at a novel by Cormac McCarthy like Child of God, that's a novel that I love, I thought, wow, it's so funny and weird and wonderful, and I don't think there's almost any readership for that. I'm not so interested in mainstream writing. Some of my novels seem to be mainstream writing, but if you're looking closely, you'll see that it's sort of meta, like a simulation of something rather than the actual thing. I have to write that way, I think, in order to even have a publisher. It's a bait and switch. I think Cormac McCarthy is exactly like that, but it's sort of like you're just doing some unique thing over in the corner of the field. Over here, Monet is painting the haystacks, and here Van Gogh is painting something different. Then you walk around, and there's Hieronymus Bosch, and he's got this bizarre landscape. And then you walk farther, and there's R. Crumb, and then there's Picasso. These people are looking at the world, but their visions are so different. I think that we're all like that, those of us who have been writing for a while. There's Emily Dickinson over here. There's Faulkner, there's Cormac McCarthy, and I feel I'm in that territory. We're each doing some odd little thing. And I'll end with Judge John Hodgman on what to call a subway line. This is the brilliant, sarcastic Judge John Hodgman. On what to call a subway line. A native New Yorker struggles with her boyfriend's choice to refer to them by their colors. Leah writes, "My boyfriend, Matt, refers to subway lines by color. Instead of the A train, he calls it the blue line. This embarrasses me as a native New Yorker. It also doesn't work. The A, C, and E are all blue, but stop at different places." And the judge writes, "I've lived in New York City for only 30 years, but I believe that invests me with enough authority to pronounce you broken up with Matt, effective immediately. For two reasons. First, if you've already explained the subway to him once, and he still does this, he will never stop thinking he is smarter than the world. Tiresome. And you, wrong. Second, he's probably from Boston. If you wish to give him a second chance, though, leave a note for him one day to meet you at the northernmost stop on the blue line. Either you will be romantically reunited in Inwood, or Matt will be dumped at Jamaica, or vice versa." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.